because as one speaker said today, there will be change. If we take on climate change and deal with it properly, we will change the world in that process. If we don't take on global warming and don't deal with it properly, then the world will change in that process. And tonight is a good opportunity to discuss ideas around that whole process. Tonight's discussion is called, Is the Government's Emissions Trading Scheme Better Than Nothing? And we've got three really good speakers, all of whom are dedicated to understanding this issue. First of all, Peter Christoff, who's a senior lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Melbourne and vice president of the Australian Conservation Foundation. Then we'll hear from Chris Breen, who's a member of Solidarity and also a climate activist with the Climate Emergency Network. And lastly, Adam Band, who's the national convener of the Greens. Now, our speakers will speak for 15 minutes each, and then we'll have some discussion, and then they'll sum up at the end. There'll be time for questions and discussion after the main speakers. So I'm hoping that everyone will join in, because that's going to make the best kind of discussion. Okay, so to start off, I'd like you to welcome Peter Christoff from the University of Melbourne.
Thanks very much. I think it's a measure of exactly how important and how contentious the issue of climate change is and how we're going to deal with it that we've got as many people as we have here tonight. So thanks very much for coming. Let me just quickly ask, are there any climate sceptics in the room? Good. That simplifies things a little bit. Okay. What I wanted to do was to go through to look at a couple of what I think are the key questions about how and why it is that we might want to have an emissions trading scheme, why it is that we may want or may not want to have the carbon pollution reduction scheme that is currently being proposed by this government. And I do want to end by at least briefly addressing the ACF's position on what has been a very contentious issue, as I may as well tackle it now because it may well come up in questions. I'm certain we are all agreed that we are facing an issue of enormous urgency. And if we happen to look at the science, even in a cursory fashion these days, it's very clear that what we need to do globally and also in Australia is reduce our emissions by a very significant proportion, very quickly indeed. The targets that are being talked about and which are broadly accepted, to the extent that they've even turned up in the Copenhagen negotiating document, the 350 parts per million is a stabilisation target for atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases, indicates the extent to which science, the recent science, the post-IPCC report, 2007 report on climate change, has now penetrated even the sort of the darkest corridors of policy making internationally and even nationally. But we also know that in Australia in particular there's been a real struggle to grapple with that science, and the position that we have here at this point in time is very weak indeed. Now, how are we going to grapple with the issue of reducing emissions? There are a number of different positions that can be taken, and I can almost assume that you collectively will take very different positions along the way in terms of the questions and arguments that I want to touch on. Firstly, some of you may believe that we don't need to go down the path of using an emissions trading scheme or putting a price on carbon at all, that it would be better to go from 0 to 100, go straight to a process of carbon rationing, whether it is at the level of individual rationing or rationing nation by nation, a much cleaner and perhaps more direct way of apportioning the very limited emissions that we're able to have in planetary scale and at national scale. Personally, I think that that is a very good idea, but I don't think it's achievable in the short term. I don't think we have the technologies in place. We don't have the processes of negotiation in place to be able to do that in the short term, the next 10 to 15 years, which is the critical period of time for us to reduce emissions. So for me, it's a long-term and very important ambition. Having said that then, it seems to me that we do then need to rely on some sort of modified process of rationing, the one that also uses a carbon price to begin to allocate the parcels of carbon that we're going to be dealing with. And again, there's probably a division of views here. Two ways to go. Firstly, you can believe that you can have a carbon trading scheme, an emissions trading scheme broadly of the sort that the Australian government, the Europeans, and now the United States have either talked about or actually have implemented. Now, again, there's a division here. Some people believe that emissions trading schemes are fraught with problems, that the markets that they are centrally responsible for or depend on are so inefficient that it is better to go down the path of a carbon tax, that a carbon tax is simpler and more direct. Personally, my position is that a carbon tax is not as good as and is no less politically fraught than emissions trading schemes. So a quick comment on that. With a carbon tax, you would simply have a generalised price on carbon, but what you wouldn't have is a cap on the amount on the actual amount of emissions. A cap and trade scheme, which is what most emissions trading schemes involve, has a cap, a limit on greenhouse gas emissions or carbon emissions, at least for the sectors that it covers. A carbon tax does not. Some people believe that a carbon tax would be politically easier. Frankly, I think you'd have exactly the same debate, the same sort of rent-seeking behaviour that we're seeing with the emissions trading scheme, with the money that a carbon tax would raise. So it would be just as politically fraught, and raising taxes always is, in terms of how the money is distributed and what is done with it, but it wouldn't have a cap. So for me, at this point, and this is also the ACF's position, an emissions trading scheme is a better place to go. Okay, so let's say we do go with an emissions trading scheme. What then makes a good emissions trading scheme? I think there are four key criteria when you look at a scheme like this. The first is its environmental effectiveness. A good, effective, environmentally effective emissions trading scheme has got to have targets which are environmentally meaningful. They begin, and these schemes reduce their caps over time. They've got to be caps which are actually meaningful in terms of what we need to avert dangerous climate change and all the catastrophes associated with it. So, environmental effectiveness. Secondly, they've got to be economically efficient. If they're going to work as markets, you have to have a clear and fair price signal. No subsidies, no mucking around internally with how that price is set. You actually do have really fierce trading under that cap. Thirdly, they've got to be equitable. And there are serious equity issues when you get into markets of any sort. So clearly, when you're raising a substantial amount of money from a tax, which is what it is in one form, which has really different impacts on those who are wealthy, including companies and households, and those who are poor, who pay a substantially greater proportion of their income on energy prices, you need to deal with that inequity, or the equity problem, if you like, and have some sort of process of subsidisation support to deal with low-income households in particular. So the equity issue is the third criterion. The last one is flexibility. The trouble with an emissions trading scheme which is inflexible, and there have been some proposed which are hugely inflexible, is that if you find the science shifting, as it seems to do almost on a daily basis, and you've locked in emissions trading targets for the next 20 years or 50 years or 100 years, and believe me, Warwick McKibben, who's on the Reserve Bank Board, was talking about 100 years, and he was very persuasive, or seemed to be so, when the Howard government was in power. Inflexibility leaves you with a catastrophe. You have to have a scheme that can be adjusted fairly quickly. Okay, there are also limitations for emissions trading schemes in general. And one of the clear limitations is that the scheme generally is most likely not to cover all sectors of the economy. It's very hard to get a whole of economy, all gases version of emissions trading up, certainly in a short period of time. A real critical problem that we have to have, and I want to come back to that in terms of the issue of compensatory or complementary measures. Okay, having said that, then how does the government's CPRS compare? Without a doubt, and the ACF is very clear about this, as am I personally, it is a shocker against almost all of these criteria. Okay, its targets are exceptionally weak. It's talking now about a 5 to 25% target band, but with the emphasis very strongly on the 5%, the 15% is qualified, the 25% is hugely qualified. As we know, a 25% emissions reduction target in a global context is very poor indeed, and it would barely get us below, around the 2-degree mark, the tripping point for dangerous climate change, and is almost likely to be useless even at that point. Secondly, in terms of the issue of efficiency, market efficiency, the CPRS has got a price that is capped at $10 for its first year of operation. It's got a price that is capped at $40 for the next 4 or 5 years of its operation. So it's not going to be a free and fair and effective market. There's a problem there. But in terms of introducing it, that may work. Thirdly, very importantly, it is full of substantial subsidies. Something in the vicinity of about $2.5 billion is going to be offered to the emissions-intensive industries and sectors to buffer their responses, their need to respond to this particular market mechanism. So the market's really powerfully undermined, and we're going to be spending a very substantial amount of money doing that. Fourthly, there's the issue of offsets. In fact, at the moment, the scheme looks like it has got this gaping hole out at the side where companies can buy in carbon credits or offsets internationally to the point where you almost don't have a national cap at all. You can simply buy your carbon credits on the international market and continue to raise your emissions domestically. There's a small qualification that can be made there. I can talk about it, but I won't bore you with it. Fifthly, don't like this scheme much, do I? There's the equity issue. There is a substantial, about half the money that will be raised by the CPRS is going to be reallocated to deal with equity issues in terms of households. But that reallocation, the equity allocation, if you like, deals not only with low-income households, but also with middle-income households, people who should be forced to respond to carbon prices, but who are going to be very strongly subsidised. No problem with dealing with the equity issues to do with low-income households, significant problems with the high the higher income end. There's no reason for that buffering. Lastly, in terms of flexibility, the scheme has got some flexibility built into it, and I think it probably isn't all that bad in that sense, in that if you're talking about the real world of investment, there are issues there about how quickly you can change targets. It's got a 5-year adjustment period. It's not great, and one assumes that if things change dramatically, you can always put in legislation in place and buy out all of the faults and flaws of the CPRS. So the CPRS is deeply, deeply flawed. And the ACF, irrespective, and I'll explain the position that it took earlier in May, even when it took that position, broadly acknowledging and supporting the CPRS as a mechanism, the ACF was then and remains now highly critical of the CPRS, the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, the Emissions Trading Scheme the government is putting forward in its legislation, for each of these reasons. So there's a question there. Should we or shouldn't we have something as highly flawed as this? And this is the argument which is dividing the environment movement to some degree at this point in time. There are some who are certainly saying, and I deeply respect their views, that it is better not to have this scheme at all than to have something as flawed as this put in place at this point in time. There's still a long way to go in the parliamentary process in terms of adjustments and changes and modifications. But there's a very persuasive argument to say that the scheme is so deeply flawed that it will lock us into all sorts of problems. At this point in time, I think we have a great deal of campaigning to do to make sure, or to try and make sure, that the scheme is not going to be as poor as it currently is. Having said that, it's also the case, and any of you who've been listening to the news in the last week would know, or went to the rally, that there has been an Agenda B put forward, which is an alternative, or a supplementary, approach to deal with the flaws of emissions trading. I've got to say that, from where I sit, Agenda B is not an alternative. Let me explain what I mean by that. Agenda B, which is the plan that was put forward by Greenpeace and the Conservation Councils and others, is a series of very, very important and very fine measures which begins to deal with the failures of an emissions trading scheme. I'm going to play with your minds in terms of alternative. It's not an alternative because it's an absolutely essential complementary component of any sort of action that we need on emissions trading. It's not an alternative. We have to have what that is going to do, what Agenda B is going to do, because emissions trading and market-based mechanisms are too weak to drive change where it needs to go. So the plan that Greenpeace and others have put forward, and which is broadly supported, though not letter by letter, by the ACF and others, encourages governments to put substantial money into renewable energy, into public transport, into the reconfiguration of cities around Australia, into driving forward energy efficiency measures, all of those things which pricing mechanisms like the ETS, the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, may not do precisely enough. We know from our experience working with governments at this point in time, the CPRS has almost whipped out from under the, in some cases quite happily for those policy makers and politicians who are concerned, but has certainly withdrawn the oxygen from those at the state level in particular who thought they could work on climate policy but who now believe that the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, the market mechanism, is going to do all their work for them. We know from the European experience that an ETS, an emissions trading scheme, doesn't do everything, and we need the alternative. It's not an alternative, it's a substantial complementary measure, and Agenda B is actually a very important component for all of this. Okay, so let me then end with a couple of quick comments then about the contentious issue of why it is that the ACF then seemed to have come out in favour of the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. This drives us back to the issue of targets. I want to talk about politics, brutal, ugly, insufficient, inadequate politics of climate change in Australia. Up until May the 4th, we had a government which was absolutely determined to put in place legislation which was going to, at best, give us a 15% reduction target through its Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme and more generally. We knew, the ACF and others knew, we all knew, that it was also going to take that target into the international negotiating forum of Copenhagen. which was catastrophic. We know that even 25% is too little, but if you have countries, like Japan is at the moment and America is at the moment, going for something even below 25%, then we are really writing off the next 10 years. So it seemed to the ACF, at an extremely high cost in some senses, that it was worth backing a change to the parameters that were going to be argued for in terms of emissions reduction, and which will be carried forward by Australia into the negotiating forum in Copenhagen, which is, at the end of the day, the most important negotiating forum. We know that Australia can't do it all alone, even if we went for 25 or even 40% emissions reduction unilaterally, which I believe we should do. We still wouldn't be resolving the issue of climate change. We have to, and we have to somehow push the bar up. If that process involved providing some support to the government on its legislation, though retaining the right to be highly critical of the legislation's flaws, the ACF believed that it was a gamble worth taking. We don't know whether it's going to deliver 25% in the international forum, but having Australia there and arguing for that target seems to us, and I endorse this very strongly, seems to us a gamble worth taking, because the alternative was simply much worse. Okay, let me just end by raising a hypothetical. Where would we be at this point in time, or several years into the future, if we didn't have a carbon pollution reduction scheme? Bearing in mind that it is going to bring into the coffers of government billions of dollars annually. At the moment, very poorly apportioned, but nevertheless, if we can argue for it to be reallocated to mitigation and adaptation measures, it's a very, very significant additional amount of money. I would argue that without that scheme in place, or a scheme like it, we simply wouldn't have the revenue, because we don't have the political will to raise the revenue by any other means, to do the sort of work that we need to do in terms of mitigation and adaptation, to do the sort of work we need to do in terms of energy efficiency measures, public transport, renewable energy, so on and so forth. So this is the perilous debate and discussion I think we're having within the movement. How far are we prepared to compromise to at least get a measure up, which will eventually, and hopefully sooner than any other measure, provide us with revenue and provide us with at least some sort of cap for reducing emissions in a political context which is extremely conservative, and in the economic context is paralysed with fear in relation to the threats that are being delivered to it by industry in terms of job losses, so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, it's a very complex, very nuanced and quite depressing political landscape in which I think various groups are taking different positions as best they can.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Peter. And I think it's a very good point to end his speech on, because there's so much we could be talking about tonight, but I think, as Peter said at the beginning, no one in the audience admitted to being a climate sceptic, which means that we all here tonight probably agree that there is a problem with the climate and that global warming is an issue. The question for us is a political one. I mean, global warming and climate change has become a political issue for us, particularly in Australia. We are one of two of the most seriously affected by climate anyway. So that's why we're having this meeting tonight, to discuss through the political issues. How do we deal with global warming and climate change, and specifically focusing on the emissions trading scheme tonight? But it's the politics behind it. And with that in mind, I'll welcome now Chris Breen, who's a political activist in the climate movement and a member of Solidarity. He's a socialist activist. So thanks, Chris.
Okay, there's a lot of things wrong with the government's carbon pollution reduction scheme, or CPRS. From the low targets to the handouts to big polluters to the offset scam, which is going to see, even with those low targets, the majority of emissions reductions not made in Australia but bought from developing countries like Indonesia or Papua New Guinea. And there are so many things wrong with the scheme, I couldn't cover them all in my allotted 15 minutes, and Peter's already gone over a number of them. I mean, both the ACF and the Greens have shared many of the same criticisms. What the Australian Conservation Foundation and the Greens won't do, I think, is come out and say that carbon trading is unfair and it's not actually going to work. The Australian Conservation Foundation has given overall support to the government's legislation, and the Greens, while rejecting it in its current form, have indicated that they were willing to accept a version of the scheme with all of the flaws, the handouts to the polluters intact, if the minimum target was raised to 25%. And so, when I say it's unfair, What I mean is that carbon trading will raise energy prices that will hit the poor and working class people the hardest. And it won't substantially reduce emissions. You can't actually make emission cuts of the scale we need in the time we need using price signals of any sort, whether that's a tax or whether that's a trading scheme. For instance, with the current CPRS, it's expected to raise electricity prices around about $6 a week. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, not compared to the water prices we're expected to double because of the diesel plant. But when you start to talk about the sort of cuts that we actually need, of 80% or more, that the science is telling us, to try and do that with price signals would quite literally mean people being unable to afford electricity, people being forced out of their cars and stuck in the suburbs. The only way you can actually make cuts of that kind of scale without a catastrophic fall in living standards is to make a political decision to use direct government investment to switch our sources of energy away from coal and towards renewable energy. I also think not only will the legislation not work, but it's not intended to work. I think the legislation is intended to make sure that any climate action is acceptable to big polluters, acceptable to big business and free market supporters, while confusing or conning enough of the population that the government is actually acting on climate change. I think in that regard, the legislation's complexity is part of its purpose. Because actually, we do know what needs to be done around climate change, and it's pretty simple. Well, I mean, it's simple for me to say, actually, achieving it is another thing, and but I'll get to that a bit later on. But what we actually need to do is this, and I think Plan B was very good in one regard. It didn't rule out a CPRS entirely, but it did start to outline what government should be doing without a CPRS. I think you need to go a bit further, though. What we need to do is we need to switch to 100% renewable energy. We need to electrify transport. We need a massive investment in public transport to get people out of their cars. We need to stop destroying forests. Actually, we need to plant more trees. And we actually need to directly regulate emissions at the point of production. There has to be a level where you say you just can't do it. Much like with CFCs, when they were phased out, it hasn't happened entirely. But rather than having a trading scheme, governments just came out and banned them. And so I think, your risk being reduced of getting skin cancer today is directly related to not having a trading scheme around those things. I mean, there's actually more that needs to be done, but those were the major things. And all of these things involve political decisions rather than trading schemes. All of these things would also create jobs, hundreds of thousands of jobs, if they were acted upon seriously. Carbon trading is also an experiment which has failed at least three times, to my knowledge. In New South Wales, the government greenhouse abatement scheme crashed dramatically in 2007. It's basically been abandoned because there was an oversupply of permits. Carbon trading has also failed in Europe, where it's been in for 3 years and emissions are still rising. Not only has it failed, but polluters have made windfall profits out of it. When the current five-year phase wraps up, it's estimated that some of the big polluters will have made between $23 and $71 billion in windfall gains. Now, the reason they've made these money is essentially because they got permits hidden, given out for free, which they can then trade and sell. These are not figures that I'm making up. And the third failure, I think, was the failure of the scheme that carbon trading was originally based on. You see, carbon trading was pushed into the Kyoto Protocol by the United States delegation, in spite of the fact that they didn't sign it. It was pushed in by people partly who were free market fundamentalists, and partly there were delegates from ExxonMobil and from Peabody Coal who knew exactly what they were doing because they'd seen a trading scheme before and they knew they had nothing to worry about. Carbon trading was based on the sulfur dioxide regime in the United States. Sulfur dioxide is the cause of acid rain. It also comes from coal, which is why they knew about it. In 2010, that scheme is going to wrap up in the United States. It's expected it will have reduced emissions by about 35% over 20 years. However, it's worth comparing that with in Germany over a time period of 15 years, where they simply banned sulfur dioxide. They reduced emissions by 98%. This also drove a whole lot of innovation because companies had to adapt to the new regime. I think the Labor Party knows and is worried that there is an alternative to the CPRS. So Greg Combe told Parliament recently, given the high public support for action to be taken and also our international obligations, failure to pass the scheme means there'll be pressure on government to turn to other measures. He said this may lead to calls for direct government regulation of emissions at a national or state level. He went on to talk about it might also lead to, you know, new regulations for buildings and things that are high in carbon. And I think direct government regulation and investment is exactly what the climate movement should be fighting for. It should be demanding that Labor stops negotiating with the Liberals and begins to take the action that it was promised when it was elected. The other question, I guess, that got raised was Copenhagen. What about Copenhagen? I think that really is, you know, the one of the central arguments around the Australian conservation support for the scheme, that on balance, in spite of the flaws, the possibility of a 25% target made that worthwhile. I think the first thing to say about that is that the science says that 25% is not enough. That's going to lead to disaster anyway. The second thing is that the government is on record as saying that such an agreement is impossible at Copenhagen, which is probably one of the true things they've said around climate change. And thirdly, just in case the agreement comes with fine print, which says the ALP will actually only agree to that 25% if developing countries agree to a series of conditions, including 20% less than business as usual, which the ALP knows full well that the developing countries are never going to agree to. I mean, people want Copenhagen to deliver a deal, but I think the reality is that our movement isn't strong enough yet, and that our leaders are still too stuck within the limits of the system. They're too concerned about their own national competitive advantage that we will not see a deal to save the world at Copenhagen. I think our leaders, our rulers, will quite literally go to war when the reality of climate change hits to fight for what's left of their patch rather than come to agreement. I mean, you can witness, for instance, Kevin Rudd is spending $35 billion on new submarines for defence over 10 years. That money could repower Victoria and half of New South Wales on renewable energy. You know, it's the political will which is lacking. And I think fourthly and most importantly, the real political impact of the support for the CPRS by the not only the ACF but the Climate Institute, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, the ACTU and ACOS is domestic and not international. It's to provide green cover, I think, for a scheme which isn't going to work. So Lindsay Tanner, the Labor MP for Melbourne, was quite explicit about it on his blog when he said, "While reasonable people can be critical of the scheme, the fact that the Australian Conservation Foundation and the Climate Institute have indicated it's acceptable, if not ideal, suggests that supposed hardline environmentalists threatening to vote it down with climate change sceptics are playing an irresponsible and reckless game." And unfortunately, I think such cover works. It confuses people. I mean, it wasn't so long ago I ended up having a Mother's Day lunch with my partner and her mother. And her mother doesn't know a whole lot about climate change, but she knows that I'm concerned about it. And the first thing she said to me as we sat down to lunch, "Isn't it fantastic that the government has raised its targets to 25%? And of course, it's not fantastic because that 25% is not going to do it, and they actually haven't raised it there. But I think her comment came directly from the support of, you know, the ACF, the ACTU, and so forth. It means that it confuses people, it takes the urgency off the need to put pressure on government. And finally, I want to deal with a few other questions that some people have raised in the climate movement. Could the scheme be fixed? Or could we have an emissions trading scheme and renewable energy and everything else? And if people don't say that explicitly, I think sometimes they say it implicitly when people think we shouldn't campaign against the scheme, but we should just deal with coal or we should just fight for renewable energy. Firstly, can it be fixed? I think there's always a fantasy market scheme in a textbook somewhere which is going to work. In textbooks, you can find a perfect capitalism in which people don't starve to death in the third world, in which there aren't booms and slumps and markets don't crash. You can find examples where privatisation makes life better for workers and carbon trading works. But at some point, you actually have to look at what our rulers do and not what they say. And since the Rio Earth Summit, we have had 17 years of failure. Since the Kyoto Protocol, we have had 12 years of failure. And that is absolutely tied to the failure of market mechanisms like carbon trading. So the answer is no. And the answer, I think, is also no about whether you can have both. But I think both practical and political reasons. Practically, the coming emissions trading scheme, the CPRS, has already knocked a number of various state government initiatives on the head because if state governments reduce their emissions under the scheme, which has a cap, by spending on renewables, it simply frees up permits for polluters. So there was a leaked Victorian ministerial brief advising the state government it should now only bother with green measures if they are more cost effective than alternatives. Then Professor Garnaut and Heather Ridout of the Australia Industry Group, a big powerful business lobby group, and the Productivity Commission have all called for the mandatory renewable energy target of 20% by 2020 to be phased out once emissions trading comes in, because it would be a distortion of the market. And the 20% target is the one measure that the ALP currently has, perhaps from, apart from insulating houses, that is actually going to work. And there will be pressure to get rid of that if you have the scheme comes in. So politically, I think it comes back to the intention of the legislation. It's not intended to work, but to take pressure off government. It is going to be, the legislation is going to be defeated this parliamentary sitting, now that Steve Fielding has outed himself as a climate denier. But I think that defeat is not a setback for the movement, but an opportunity for the movement to start to argue for the things that really need to be done. And what we really need, I think, is the political effort to build a movement capable of forcing the government to act. And if the climate movement doesn't oppose the legislation, the emissions trading scheme, I think it's going to find it hard to build the movement. If a CPRS comes in, activists are going to find it hard when a substantial portion of the population think that the government is acting on climate change, or at least confused, if we don't have a razor-sharp argument against it. When the movement calls for more renewable energy, the government's response is going to be that they already have a plan and it's called the CPRS. I think as well, if sections of the climate movement are seen to support rising energy prices combined with windfall profits for big business, which I think would be an inevitable part of carbon trading, it will be a barrier to working class participation in the movement, and all of that matters. Because I think the only way that we're going to overcome the obstacles in our past, and the obstacles are immense, and implement real solutions is when we have a movement across the globe that is politically clear about its demands and powerful enough to force change, powerful enough to be a counterweight to the big polluters and big business that are currently setting the agenda. And if we don't build that movement, those people who are currently setting the agenda, along with Kevin Rudd, are going to continue to set the agenda. We need a movement big enough and strong enough that workers in the movement have the confidence where they can get to the point to say, we will not build any new coal-fired power stations or fossil fuel infrastructure. You know, some people think that's utopian, but it's happened before. It happened with uranium, where workers in this country refused to move uranium across the country. It happened with the green bans in New South Wales, where workers refused to destroy bushland and build inappropriate development. That is the sort of movement we need. So not only will carbon trading not work, but it's an obstacle to building that movement. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Now, our next speaker is from the Greens Party. I was getting involved in environmental issues back in the 70s, actually. I was around when the Green Bans campaigns were actually working. And the Green Party was just setting up really then, and we didn't have representation in the Parliament by an organisation that would actually stand up for the environment and for justice for ordinary people, really. And it's important, I think, that we do have Adam here tonight, because the Greens have become a real part of the parliamentary political climate. And recently at Melbourne University, Bob Brown turns up to give a speech on climate, and 400 people turned out to see him. And I think that's a combination. The climate issue is so important, but they have so much hope that a party in Parliament like the Greens can actually deliver something. And I suppose there's a lot of a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of a parliamentary party, but I think there's a responsibility here, and I'm so glad that Adam's come along to explain the position of the Greens as well. So welcome, Adam Bandt.
Thanks for that lovely introduction, and for everyone for turning out, especially on Tuesday night. And it's precisely because we are a political party that are seeking to represent these concerns that probably most people in the room here share at a federal level, that gives me the greatest source of frustration when environment groups come out and publicly identify themselves with the ALP. And I think that that's something I want to come back to later on, and that's probably, despite all the other things that we agree on this table, that's probably the biggest political issue. That's probably my main point of difference with Peter. It's probably not the science, it's the politics, and I think that's where this debate is heading. I'll come back to that, as I say, at the end, but I think it really is the central question that we're all, when we say, is the government's emission trading scheme better than nothing? We can't ignore that this is now rapidly becoming a fundamentally, like, big P political problem, one of the biggest moral and political issues that we and the planet, and especially us here in a country like Australia, have faced for quite some time. The last election, everyone, I think, Greens included, certainly not everyone, the majority of the population, the Greens included, were so keen to get rid of John Howard that Labor was able to slip under the radar. Labor didn't have to say anything other than they weren't John Howard to win the election. Surprisingly, they did try and run the election on the basis that they were John Howard, and Kevin Rudd took out as many advertisements as he could to say that there wasn't a sliver of daylight between the two, but nonetheless, they won. But they got away. We as the movement, the environment groups, demanded nothing from Labor prior to the election, and that's exactly what they got. They got a Labor Party that came to power saying, we'll announce our targets after we're in, and we'll tell you what we're going to do when we're in, just trust us. And since they've come in, it's been a string of disappointments. The first being the 5%, announcing 5% was the target. Then announcing it was going to be delayed. Then all the other things about the CPRS, which I'll go through in a moment, but that many of which have been covered. And that has generated, I think, a lot of anger. And I think genuinely people thought Kevin Rudd was going to do something a bit more than what he's done. What he's done, what's become apparent, is that for him, this is just another political issue like any other political issue, to be focus grouped, to be tested, to be messaged, to work out how to triangulate people so that he gets people on both sides criticising him. It's a favourite tactic. You can see it in industrial relations, and you see it in this as well. Well, I've got the lefty groups, the greeny groups criticising me, and I've got the industry criticising me on the other side, so I must be doing something right. And that's basic political tactic, and it's what he's wheeling out here. So it's not being grappled with as a political moral question, it's being just another political issue to manage. And you can see that in a number of respects with this CPRS. The targets are nowhere near what's needed, and they're based on 450 parts per million, which pretty much the rest of the world has agreed is not, puts us at dangerous risk. It makes it more likely than not that we're going to get into that tipping point of dangerous climate change. It's condemning the Great Barrier Reef. It's condemning most of Kakadu. I mean, on the existing science, this is what the concentration of parts per million that they're building this around is extraordinarily dangerous. And even if their highest target was implemented, Australians on average would still end up emitting per capita double of what Europeans on average do if the Europeans implement their targets. So there's lots of talk about dressing this up to say we're starting from a high base, etc., etc. Well, we've come off years and years of a dodgy deal negotiated with respect to the Kyoto Protocol by the previous government, and we are going to end up leading the world even if their highest targets are implemented. Having said that, I think you can forget about the higher end targets pretty much straight away, because almost all the conditions for the meeting of the higher end targets have already been have already not been met, and you can see regular newspaper reports that describe this higher target as an obnoxious higher target, because it's insisting, as Chris pointed out, on developing countries making certain cuts, which already most people are saying that the highest target's almost certainly not going to be met. But most crucially, it fails to take the leadership that we as a high-polluting country need to take. And the Copenhagen range, to the extent that 25% figures in it, it figures at the bottom end. The guiding range for this round of Copenhagen debates is 25 to 40, and that 25 to 40 was set out on the basis that the higher polluters would be at the top, doing the 40. And so what is being proposed by Rudd is going to the meeting and saying, we will give you the absolute minimum that could be expected, and we won't come near the top end of what you're actually asking us to do. So it's not going to Copenhagen with an open hand, it's going to Copenhagen with tied hands. It's giving $16 billion in compensation to some of the country's biggest polluters. Every dollar that goes to them is a dollar less that can be spent on renewable energy, and it's a dollar that's coming from your pockets if you're a taxpayer. And this comes on the back of massive spendathons over the last year. The kitty is rapidly emptying, and to take another $16 billion out of it and give it straight to polluting industries, who are doing very well, thank you very much, and have done so for quite a number of years, to suggest that they need another $16 billion is completely outrageous. And even the Productivity Commission has come out and said there's going to be no proper price signals sent by this legislation by giving so much compensation to polluting industries. Okay, so it's not even going to do the job that they're saying, because so much money is being redirected away from renewable energy straight to the coal industry and to polluting industries. You can't... the permits... the system is set up in such a way, as the Australia Institute has pointed out on a number of occasions, that you build a new solar power station. If you and your friends get together in your street to install solar panels on your roofs, all you do is free up more permits for the polluting industries to be able to use, and they haven't fixed that problem yet. That's a fixable problem. You throw away the excess permits and they haven't fixed that. That's a very easy thing that they could do. Huge numbers of industries are exempted. They're going to delay it for a year. You can buy unlimited permits overseas, so you can effectively outsource pollution to third world countries. I mean, you have it happening with sweatshop labour, now we're going to have it with climate change and greenhouse gas pollution as well. And most appallingly, I think, is that it does absolutely nothing to tackle the export of coal, and the export of coal from Australia alone is our whole greenhouse gas emission production twice, or once over. So this will be allowed to continue. And in fact, if you look at the recent stimulus payment, the budgets and the massive amount of money that's been spent there, those stimulus payments are about making it easier to export coal by new rail and road facilities in Newcastle and places like that. So in the recent recent round in the budget, you had the building of four new solar power stations, and that is great. All of that put together is less than one compensation given to one major coal industry project in the Hunter Valley. So what we're saying here is a scheme that fails to tackle what needs to be tackled if we're really going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I think it ought to be sort of named for what it is. And this isn't a debate about an ideal emissions trading scheme. We've got to look at what's actually being put on the table. And what's being put on the table has been termed, which I think was quite nice, this was someone called it the other day, the continue polluting regardless scheme. And that's exactly what it is. And so we shouldn't be caught up, I don't think, on a debate about would we like an ideal emissions trading scheme. If they came around and said that we're going to introduce an emissions trading scheme where there's 70% cut in greenhouse reduction by 2020, I think you would find most people would say that's a great idea. But that's not what is on the table. So is it better than nothing? Well, I think it's worse than useless. And I think it's going to lock in a continued high polluting economy here in Australia. I think it is going to drag Copenhagen down, because we are going in with the bottom end of the target that's expected from developed nations at the highest, when 40% is being called for. Going in without such a low target and without hands tied would be much, much better, and would allow us to go in with a straight face and ask for developing countries to make higher cuts. If we then made correspondingly higher cuts ourselves, and I think we have a moral obligation to do that. But how we can go into Copenhagen saying 25% is the absolute highest and we want you, India, to commit to 20% is just fanciful. And to think that it's going to, that this new scheme and that this deal that's being done with respect to the CPRS is going to help Copenhagen is, I think, completely wrong. What it is going to do here domestically is going to give the appearance of something being done. And as I say, I think this is focus group and workshop to death by Rudd, and I think they know. I mean, you look at the polls, most people don't understand the emissions trading scheme. But once it's passed, they'll think, well, that's good, they've done something. Something is through. And once it's passed, they'll also, I reckon you could also do another poll, and most people will think the target's 25%, for the reasons that Chris outlined. I think we need to understand that this is their plan. This is their plan to deal with this, and I think it's fanciful to think that once this is through, we can come back for another bite of the cherry. This is going to redivert substantial resources to polluting industries, and we are not going to get those back. We are not going to get that money to put into solar or into wind or into geothermal. That is gone. And as I said, this is on the back of a spendathon, which could have been a fantastic opportunity to jumpstart a green economy and wasn't. The $42 billion, I mean, imagine how you could have rapidly transformed. If we decided that $42 billion was going to be spent making wind turbines in Gippsland, or in the Latrobe Valley, so that as we phase out coal, all those people will get jobs in the wind industry, making, you know, we'll need steel for those wind turbines, let's make the manufacturing plants down there. We could have done that. They weren't even thinking like that. We've missed a lot of opportunities. And I think I mentioned IR before, industrial relations. Again, look there. You've got the unions now saying, well, you didn't give us much of what we thought. We want a second round of industrial reform. And they're saying, no, that was it. You've had your chance. That was it. And I think it's going to be exactly the same with this. This legislation will go through. If it goes through, which is looking unlikely at the moment, I've got to say, I think it's very likely that the Liberal Party will cave because they've got too much to lose at a double dissolution election. And they'll probably just accept it going through. There's a reason that they accept the 5 to 25% targets. It's because they know that 25% is never going to happen. That's why they've accepted it. And so I think that's probably what's likely to happen. But we've got to realise this is their plan to deal with it. There won't be a complementary plan B. There won't be an opportunity to come back for another go because this is their plan. If your house is on fire, you call someone to come and put it out. Right? You don't sit around debating whether to set up a fire truck trading scheme or what the price of the water will be to put it out, you just put it out. And if you look at what has just happened as the response to the financial crisis, it gives you a guide as to what we're able to do. Trillions of dollars spent in a very short period of time with legislation getting through in a fortnight when countries got together and said this is an emergency. Well, if we can save the banks, why can't we save the planet? That is exactly the same kind of international coordinated effort that's needed with respect to climate change. This plan is effectively like saying to Kevin Rudd, the house is on fire, and he says, well, I'll fill up the ute with some water and bring it round and we'll see if that works. What do you think about that? It's an inadequate response, and we've got every right to say no, go back to the drawing board and come up with another plan. There's no reason to accept what is an inferior plan, because as I say, this really is a critical opportunity. What would such a plan look like? Well, I think one of the first things we could do is incorporate into a plan stopping logging. There's various estimates, but stopping logging of old growth in Australia is going to reduce the country's emissions somewhere between 10 and 20%. Energy efficiency measures, a huge investment in energy efficiency. We saw a start of it with the insulation. Well, why not more? Because just that alone is going to reduce, again, you could get up to 10% greenhouse gas emission reduction from the country just by using existing technology. You could do it all at Bunnings. You just put in a bulk order at Bunnings and pay some people to go and install it. But I'm not joking. I mean, like, it's not difficult stuff. And we need capital intensive grants or funding for some of this stuff. Now, I just want to make a minor point about this ETS market versus direct government intervention. I side on direct government intervention. I think it's the only thing within this period of time that can act quickly enough to save us. I don't like the idea of giving the people responsible for the global financial crisis yet another instrument to be with. We don't have to play with. We don't have 20 to 30 years to work out rights and wrongs. We need to do it quickly. But having said all of that, the government is intervening at the moment and is giving direct support. They're just giving it to the coal industry, and they should be giving it to the renewable energy industry, so they don't come to this with clean hands, as it were. Lastly, just coming back to this point about is it better than nothing, should we just pass it? as I said, it's an issue that Kevin Rudd and the Labor Party uses to, they use their basic strategy of triangulation. They're criticising me over here, they're criticising me over there, I must be getting it right, I'm doing it in the middle. Chris mentioned the Lindsay Tanner saying, well, we've got organisations coming out supporting us, the Greens are over here criticising it, the Liberals are over here criticising it, we must be doing the nice moderate thing. Every time Green groups appear on television with Penny Wong or Lindsay Tanner or someone from the Labor Party, they give support to that strategy. And it reinforces in the mind of the electorate, in my view, the general view that the Labor Party is doing something and what they're doing is enough, and that their targets are probably 25% and generally the mainstream point of view supports it. And what that then means is that when we get up in Parliament and argue for science-based targets, when we get up and try and give a voice to what the world scientists are unanimously telling us we need to do within a very short period of time, we get labelled as extremists. And if we are going to have any hope of getting out of this within the next 10 years, with the planet and the human race as we know it intact in some form, we need to do what the scientists are telling us. And we need to stop giving credence to the view that following the science is extremism. And I think that is the biggest political issue that we've got to challenge at the moment. And it's a hard one. And you'll see opinion pieces about it in the paper all the time at the moment. How do you get through to people that doing what the science is saying is necessary? And unfortunately, people think it's going to involve hardship. It could actually, we could have a fantastic new economy, a sustainable economy, a green jobs economy. I mean, what better place than Australia to lead the world in the solar industry? And yet we're lagging behind. We could do all those fantastic things if we adopted the science-based targets. And I guess what I would hope is that politics starts to change and environment groups think, well, actually what we should be doing is getting out and supporting the science-based targets and not something that's in the middle. I think it will be okay to vote down the legislation and for the legislation to go down. I think that a failure to agree is much, much better than an agreement to fail.
Thanks to all our